if you can ask a new recruit, what's our objective? Where do we play? How do we win? And they play back something like, you know, 90% accurate, you're in a good place. And if obviously around the boardroom or the senior leadership team, if you're getting different answers as a CEO, you've got to do some serious work around strategic alignment in the leadership.
It's the E-commerce Master Plan podcast, here to help you solve your marketing problems and grow your e-commerce business. Cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and advice from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello and welcome. It's great to have you here. Thank you for hitting play and choosing to listen to one of our inspiring guests. In this episode, we get to catch up with the brilliant e-commerce growth strategist, Rich Chappell. Rich has held senior roles at Play.com, The Hut Group and Gymshark. He's a marketer by heart, I think would be the right way to put it, but he's also now a strategic genius really in the space, helping many e-commerce and D2C brands work out their best path to growth. And he is joining us to share the answer to his what would you do, which is, what would you do if you were the new CEO of an eight-figure fashion brand? Make sure you listen to the end of the episode, because as well as sharing all of that, I'll be cheekily asking Rich for his take on what marketing is the best marketing to be doing in 2026. And he's sharing some absolute golden nuggets in the top tips at the very end of the episode as well. And now to introduce our special guest. Rich Chappell was previously the CMO at Gymshark and the CEO at THG Ingenuity, part of The Hut Group, scaling both companies to unicorn valuations. He's now the co-founder at The Growth Foundation, helping e-commerce and D2C brands grow the right way. Hello, Rich.
Hi, Chloe, and hi, listeners. Looking forward to getting stuck into this.
Very cool to have you on the show. So thank you so much for suggesting this, what would you do? Before we get into that though, how did you get started in e-commerce? I think my intro barely covers a tiny, tiny fraction of your e-commerce history, Rich. So tell us a bit more about it.
Absolutely. So I actually started off on the shop floor at Homebase here in the UK in the mid-90s. And I know you're listening to us, but in the room I'm in my home office, which is a studio, and I'm a massive fan. I'm very passionate about music. So I was obviously trying to earn some money to fund my musical passions, being in a band and stuff, and effectively grew up in retail, actually fell in love with it and got a junior marketing job at Carpet Right. So still within the home improvement category. And you're thinking, why are you sticking around in home improvement? It's obviously like family connections and family sort of building contractors and electricians and things like that. But actually my passion was to say is in music. And I, in terms of e-commerce, actually fell in love with e-commerce as a consumer, early adopter. So I was the guy in the group of friends that would be early adopter on actually getting an internet connection in the early 90s on dial-up, you know, first one with an email, first person to spend hundreds of pounds on a DVD player, all those things, and was desperate to work in that industry, but managed to grab a job at Play.com in the early 2000s, Chloe, if you remember that brand.
I do, and that would have been like the must have job back then. They were the case study on everything.
I'm just phenomenal. So I joined as a marketing manager and grew up to head of marketing in that business. I joined at around 20 million turnover. The business was profitable back then, selling discs in boxes predominantly, and that grew to 500 million in the space of about 4.5 years while I was there. Just bananas. And I'm conscious of our time together, but so to sort of really what fueled that growth. But ultimately, combination of two things: the addressable market growing massively with people going from analog to digital, people going straight to broadband, not to dial up, you know, or via dial up. But also we managed to stay on top of that opportunity and not let Amazon, our arch enemy at the time, overtake the market share that we held onto and grew over that time, particularly in video and video games. So yeah, absolutely loved it. Really deep down as a passion of mine in terms of entertainment, it was a phenomenal business to work for, and actually met some incredible operators in that business that have gone on to do very amazing things in the e-commerce, I suppose, community, in terms of those sort of, you know, I suppose us in the early Wild West of e-com when Google had just opened its sort of search advertising, Facebook was only a social media platform you couldn't advertise on, etc. So yeah, really good. They say went off then to THG, had a number of roles there. Actually then went sort of freelance and then met Gymshark as part of that journey. And that's brought me up to the Grow Foundation. And I can tell you a bit more about that as and when during our time together.
So you, like me, got to play around in the early days where I think of e-commerce as being kind of like a crazy land grab.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everyone was adopting. Yeah, the Wild West, the consumers were just piling in. Yes, we had to do clever things to keep growing and to keep selling. But nowadays, with levels of competition, everything, I think it's a lot harder. Do you think it's changed a lot over that time span, how you go up the mechanics of growing a brand?
I think the principles, and maybe we'll get into them in our content in a minute, I think there's some that are evergreen. And even with a similar paradigm shift, you could argue the AI has a similar Wild West feeling about it at the moment.
Yeah.
I think even with those in place, those frameworks that I've, I suppose, spotted, been part of putting in place or actually testing and learning through are applicable, because I suppose it comes down to the execution channel as the things that are changing. But you're right. It is tougher now. I suppose, you know, if I go back to those early days for us, Chloe, there was only, I remember looking at similar web data or the equivalent back then, and there were like only like, let's say, hundreds of sites with over 1 million visitors a year, right? And there are now, I suppose, tens of thousands. So, you know, it was just again that early time, right, in terms of competition. And particularly, again, if we remember technically, you had to have quite, I suppose, weapons grade development help to get an e-commerce site working to do millions of turnover, right? Now you can go on to Shopify or other platforms and you can be trading within a couple of hours with a very beautiful kind of templated site ready to go. Oh. Right. So you met the difficulty of actually connecting a payment gateway to a website, you know.
Oh, there's about 20 tangents of PCI DSS implementation and the mind-blowing thing of when Shopify came around. But let's...
I mean, I'll give you just very quickly to bring that to life for the listeners. I suppose when I was at Play.com, right? So we're a department store for entertainment. Actually, interestingly, well over 1 million SKUs, not all in stock. But that development team at the time, around sort of 500 million, would have been around 100 people maintaining a Hybris environment. And I could roll forward to Gymshark, for example, or on Shopify. The IT team that was working with Shopify directly and a few partners, but it's a team of four.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
So mad. Right. I'm not going to tangent on my tangents because we'll be here for the rest of the episode just reminiscing, which, as entertaining as that would be, is not what everyone's tuned in for. So, Rich, your what would you do is, if you were starting a new job as a CEO at an 8-figure fashion brand, what would you do?
Yeah, well, I've thought about this, and actually replaying my experience, I've entered pretty much those business I mentioned, Play, the Hut Group and Gymshark, at that 8-figure moment. And I thought about deconstructing this into the first 90 days, which I thought could be helpful for listeners.
Nice.
So, and I think there are 5 work streams that I would prioritise, but as a CEO, there are many more, as we know, to get into. But I think like truth is one, and there's truth to find all over the business. Like the strategy. So what are the guiding rules and principles that everyone's operating under? And are they really clear everywhere? So, you know, is there strategic clarity and narrative clarity everywhere on that? What's the truth about the customer? As a marketer, obviously I've been promoted to CEO, but I'm a marketer at heart. So obsessing about the customer and understanding that. I'd want to know where we are on a talent and organization point of view. And then I suppose operating leverage in terms of what's the opportunity, particularly now with AI and systems and those other things. So they're the kind of the 5 work streams I'm going to look at. And obviously they work across those sort of first 90 days, really.
Okay, so that's going backwards. That's operating leverage, talent and organization.
Yeah.
Truth of the customer, truth of strategy.
Yeah. And I suppose I actually call truth as a work stream overall, Chloe, because I think like there's things like, and I've got them like, you know, financial truth. Like what's going on there, really key. Like channel and cohort truth. So percentage of revenue is repeat versus no in our cohorts. You know, what's the Pareto? Is there a very concentrated percentage of customers? Like I've seen in many businesses, like 5% of customers generate 30% of your revenue. You know, getting to understand those things. You know, is there actually, I suppose, and a product or channel truth, you know, depending on this apparel business that I've now taken the leadership challenge on, Is it distributed across TikTok Shop, Amazon, D2C and wholesale, or is it purely direct to consumer Shopify, right? So is there a channel truth to understand? Quite often, is there a hero SKU or a hero product line truth? And quite often in the brands that I've worked with more recently that are in eight figures, founder visionary led still, there is actually a hero product. And quite often they're getting distracted by newness and other things. You're like, hang on, we need to really focus on the hero. We still haven't really unlocked that. So there's that truth, obviously the organization truth, and then those kind of things. That's what kind of what I'm after in those truths.
I love the fact you start with those truths, because I think it's so easy to assume that when you come in that high position in a big business, you take all that for granted and just start making decisions. But that's not the way to go about it, is it? You need to actually make sure that when you're looking at an apple, it's an apple. When you're looking at a pear, it's a pear, and so on. And therefore you've actually got those accurate stuff.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're the same, Chloe. I meet a number of, say, eight figure founders or, you know, investors or, senior leadership teams. And still the vast majority are still arguing about the truth on actually revenue, like net revenue yesterday, you know, excluding returns, cancellations, tax, VAT. Shopify will have its own slightly unique algorithm of what it calls sales. The finance system has a slightly different view of that. And actually, you know, getting, I suppose, understanding where some of these untruths are really quickly. And that really helps. And I'd imagine actually, look, if you've got the opportunity to join a CEO, this might be day minus 30 as you're sort of preparing to start, right? You'd start to immerse on these and get to know the business and things like that. So yeah, that's really key. You know, on the financial side, you've got, you know, gross margin by SKU, obviously contribution margin. And one of the things that we do, or I've got into the habit of doing, is grouping or lining contribution margins at different sort of, I suppose, sections, I suppose, down the P&L, as it were. I'm trying to think of a better word for it, but you know, you've got gross cost of goods, you know, and then that GP1, GP2, I look at that as brand. So any sort of more fixed mid to upper funnel investment, GP3, sort of variable performance marketing, GP4, sort of trading costs to acquire the customer at the point of sale. And you'd put potentially your payment processing fees in there, but it could be your rent for a shop or the license fee for Shopify in there as well. Ops, you know, outbound fulfillment, you know, GP5 and then GP6 overhead. So you look at all those different bandings right the way down to GP7, final one, sort of salary. And you can get a sense of like, where is the opportunity? And obviously great, particularly D2C businesses have brilliant GP1, right? Where you've got
a very high gross margin.
Yeah. I mean, interesting, again, going back to my play in early THG days, you know, GP1 would be like 35, 40%, which, you know, again, shows you how cheap it was to acquire customers in the early days as well, right? Compared to what it is now.
Yeah, so much so.
So yeah, that would be one. Yeah, we spoke a bit about the sort of cohort tree. So again, looking at customers through that lens. And then I think organization tree is a really interesting one. And I'm conscious, again, we could probably spend an hour talking about this, but I meet a lot of, again, those sort of early eight figure brands where you've got founder and, again, so it's like early loyalists who are friends, family, sort of founder-centric decision-making around org design. And actually that's an interesting thing to have to fix or manage in terms of how do we upskill the operating horsepower or capacity of the team, but also keep some of this loyalist in place. You know, that's a really interesting dynamic. Is there true ownership of the P&L anywhere? Actually, you know, one of the things I mentioned when we were together last is like, particularly with AI and the pace of decision-making, actually, where is the power of attorney and agency in the business? Is it truly at a performance marketer's desk, or that does it go back to the finance director every day, for example, right? Just understanding that. But yeah, that's first 30 days truth.
All about the truth. And I like the fact that you've included both the metrics, the numbers, which I was going to say call the hard and fast numbers, but as we've just gone through, they're not necessarily hard and fast. They should be, but you've got to find that truth and get them solid. But you've got that kind of the black and white of the numbers, but you've also got that softer side of, does everyone actually think we're doing the same thing? Is there, you know, confusion at the board table of what we're actually here to be? You know, are we a retailer or are we an online store or are we a marketplace seller? All that kind of cultural values, but kind of even harder than culture and values side of things that needs to be outlined.
Yeah, and this is a perfect segue actually into my next sort of month two, which is actually once you've looked at the truths and sort of captured them, I think even if there is, let's say, strategic alignment, but codifying it and then creating a system or a way of becoming a broken record and a consistent narrator of strategy throughout the business is really, really key. So we've got a framework at the Growth Foundation that we've developed. And actually, look, I've bumped into different sort of strategy frameworks and things throughout the last particularly 10 to 15 years. And I've sort of grabbed the best bits from all of them and pulled them up. But I think, you know, situation, capturing what's happening now and being brutally honest is first one, both strategically, I suppose, macro, what's going on in the market, everything else, but actually internally, strengths and weaknesses and things like that. The vision and mission. So again, why does the brand have permission or the company have permission to exist is really key for us all to remember. An objective, capturing that, which actually is very much a quantitative process of how much by when. And that's not just like revenue and an EBITDA or contribution, but also some of the softer things like maybe customer satisfaction, employee satisfaction, sentiment, and other things that you can track with high confidence. And then the way we deconstruct the strategic choices here is actually a phenomenal P&G or Procter & Gamble framework, which is where to play and how to win. And you might have bumped into that before, Chloe, but it's a lovely way of like sort of the symbiosis between the rational choices you have to make strategically and the emotional ones, and you say the hard and soft. So in the where to play, and anyone listening, I'd look at this through your own businesses. You know, who is the target audience? We mentioned about obsessing about that, which I'll come on to. The product that you make, so you know, customer, product, the channel you sell through, and the geography you're in. And you can make, obviously, you could say, well, I'm going to be to every customer, we're going to make every product in all channels, in all countries. Well, you can quickly understand that the skills, the capital, and the sort of limited resources you have a business probably won't succeed if you went, let's just do everything. So it's then coming down to how do we choose? Should we be, you know, as you say, when do we launch a new country? When do we launch into TikTok shop or not? Become quite interesting strategic choices on the where to play. And then the how to win comes after, once you've got the confidence in that where to play, is the way, almost like the way you act as a brand. So things like the offer architecture in its own right, which I look at as being, okay, what is the brand? Is there sort of some heroic myth or story we can tell? How unique is the product? Is there an irresistible call to action that we can create, which doesn't necessarily mean discount. It means could be scarcity or something that just makes people act today. And then social proof and all those kind of, it's then like the how. And also where I've helped influence and build these strategies with other brands, there's a true ability to point them externally to customers and they work, kind of this how to win sort of set of rules, but also internally in terms of how we behave as people, it works as well, if that makes sense. Like there's a kind of blurring of that internal external in terms of the way the brand behaves and how to win within those choices you make. Yeah. So I think what I've seen is quite often there can be, I suppose the litmus test for me is like, if you can ask a new recruit, you know, it doesn't matter at any level, what's our objective? Where do we play? How do we win? And they play back something like, you know, 90% accurate, you're in a good place. And if obviously around the boardroom or the senior leadership team, if you're getting different answers, then there's probably, as a CEO, you've got to do some serious work around strategic alignment in the leadership, right? That's really key.
And we're talking about this as what you would do as the CEO starting the new job, but both that month one and more, even more importantly, the month two activity, this isn't you squirreled away in your corner office working things out, is it? This is a whole company project.
Correct. Yeah. And depending on the size and complexity of that, it may be that there are, maybe it's not whole company, but very much not an insular, you know, as you say, squirreled away in the corner office. You've got to understand, particularly, I suppose, in that first month, like just getting everywhere and actually into the warehouse, get to the manufacturer, get as much truth as you can, I think is really key. And I suppose there is probably a little bit more remote synthesis in the strategy because you probably have a view if you're CEO, but actually making sure if you, let's say, create a draft in terms of, I think this is our where to play and how to win, go and get that tested and challenged across the business, actually from, you say, from junior all the way to senior levels around and find out, particularly potentially you might think as a CEO, actually we've opened a new market, for example, you know, let's say you're a 100% direct to consumer, you've got 80% of your sales in the UK, and let's say that 20% long tail is 30 countries, and the e-com team are distracted positively by launching, you know, a French website or something else, right? You could actually, is that the best use of how much energy you're spending? That's using half your week to create 5% revenue? Should we put that 50% of your time back into driving the UK more? Yeah, there might be some interesting challenges you've got. And quite often I've seen them, sometimes they're linked to people's bonuses and incentives, right? Which is, particularly around channel conflict, retail versus D2C. And there's all sorts of things going on there, isn't there, to unpack?
Yeah, so much to unpack. But I guess that's why you've got to spend that first month trying to uncover as much truth as possible. Because then as you start building the strategy, you start to then, it's a lot easier to find the conflicts and the issues.
Yeah, completely.
And I think so often when people hear you say, oh yeah, we're going to create a strategy and announce it to the team, they think it should be this big kind of wow surprise moment. But in the way you build a strategy and in what the actual strategy is, I found it's often more likely to be a, oh, cool. Oh, well, that's not unexpected. You know, it's almost like if you announce the strategy to the company and everybody's shocked or surprised, then you probably got it wrong because it should be kind of obvious in some ways.
Yeah. And often in my experience is usually doing less, but doing it better.
Yeah.
Is usually what I find happens at sort of around the eight figures, because it's just sort of got a bit distracted and not kind of really focused in on that. And I think the other thing just to keep reminding is, I suppose, as you move into month three, is like actually creating a KPI around measuring the recall of the strategic propaganda in the business. So, when I've been in other senior roles in other businesses, using a sort of a PR tactic, which is like, you might get a question from a colleague or a coworker, and then, reframing a question back that includes the strategy to say, either in your reply, the answer is this, and that's because our where to play is, just constantly referring back to it to get it into the muscle memory of the business.
Yeah, I think you said called it the consistent narrator of strategy, which I think is so critical, isn't it? You have to keep reminding everybody.
Correct, yeah, absolutely. And you find, again, I've been privy to being in quite a few different organisations, you find sometimes you get natural narrators as CEOs or in the leadership team, and sometimes there isn't a natural narrator. So it's, again, sometimes you can find other individuals in the organisation that seem to have a impact and influence and relationship with the organization, again, might be one of those legacy loyalists that have been their OG employee for. They can be really impactful on getting them on board on narration of where we're going, because obviously the trust has been built. Or or as a case, you have to proactively engineer it into particularly leadership roles, is that strategic clarity is a part of a KPI, a soft KPI, as it were, right, for that team.
So month three, what comes next after truth and strategy?
Yeah, I think, well, there's particularly probably, now I've got a bit of understanding of talent truth and things like that. So looking at then, is the organization designed for sort of scale and future scale or survival? So quite often at eight figures, I find typically underinvestment in CRM, and I'll bump into that probably a few times in our conversation today, but dedicated obsession on customer insight and customer relationship management to build LTV. I suppose the interesting one here as well is the nuance around, if the founder is still in the business, like in your CEO, working through and really understanding like decision-making governance of who's doing what is really interesting. And that might be the founder becoming more non-executive and floating around and impacting maybe product and customer and things like that, or versus, the real operating daily pulse of the business. That would be really key. And typically what I would look at doing in that third month is like future gazing into, what does the organization need to look like at twice our revenue now? And then working, right, where are the major gaps? Where do we have to prioritize, right, in terms of that? And being very pragmatic around, look, I can't tie up all our working capital I would like to buy stock and demand with by putting another 30 people in, for example, right? It has to be very pragmatic, but getting a sense of, what does that organization look like if we're twice as big? And on the current run rate, how quickly is that? So kind of 12 to 24 month horizon on that would be really key. Third month, cash and working capital discipline. So making sure all over inventory, markdown, production lead times, margin guardrails, and I suppose making any changes if the business is, let's say, weak on that would be really key. And the other thing, I suppose, is getting out to that understanding. If you've got the strategy set and happy, you can then think about the execution of that strategy. And I suppose particularly now more than ever, where is it appropriate for an AI tool or system or ways of working to help increase productivity? Or do we get, is it much more, I suppose, utilizing brand and creative, for example, or are we using more in financial and planning? And I'm sure there are opportunities across the whole business around where it can be used and how it could be leveraged. So I'd be thinking about that in particular, in tandem with the talent organization piece as well. Yeah.
Because I suppose that having your kind of your vision of where the company's going to go, but also the vision of where the organization of the people is going to go, you know, what that structure chart looks like when you've doubled, that's not just about hiring or AI these days. That's also about who you develop to get into which role, because you've got a time window until you get there of, I think Suki could actually become our head of marketing, but she needs this, 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 and this done. And by the time you get to end of month two and you're into month three, you've got some idea of who the stars are in the business, who are the best cultural fits and all those elements and how you can keep them.
Yeah. I've done that in a few other organizations I've been in where you find those, let's say, really high potential, I call them sort of high horsepower people, and given them actually, they're often leaning in, high bias for action, problem solving, and actually, you know, some of those more, I suppose, things you don't quite get to on the to-do list that are still with very much within the strategy, you know, can say like a special projects, like why don't you get together as a group and actually cross-functionally, they may not be, get them to own a task or a project that isn't maybe in their core discipline, but you're helping progress their skill outside of their core discipline as well. So you get, you know, perhaps a head of finance, a, you know, a senior performance marketing manager and a campaign manager, whatever, to get together and go, right, we've got a problem around our returns rate, fix, you know, whatever, right? And you've got smart people from different places thinking about that holistically from just, instead of just an operational challenge, for example, right? I think the other one that's really key actually in this third month, now you've got that strategic third week, it could be, because it feels like that, doesn't it?
Though? I think that's an AI goal, isn't it?
And actually, anyone listening, I'm sure as we all work in e-commerce, perhaps when we look around our peer and friend group, we realize a day in e-commerce is a week in anyone else's life. Like they generally are dog days, aren't they, in our industry. I think the governance and decision cadence as well, like, you know, weekly trading, monthly strategic reviews or quarterly offset, what's the right operating cadence for the business? And does it need to flex around peak moments or launches and things like that? You know, again, I've been in business where there's a very, I say, standard sets of, let's say, campaign ideation on a monthly basis. But actually, you know, when you get to peak intensive periods, perhaps in Q4, actually a daily stand-up, which is around blockers and, you know, it, just flexing, making sure we've got real clarity of, again, why we meet, the objective of the meeting, how frequent, are they valuable, and keeping really on top of that. Again, meetings can be a material time suck when you start to get into larger organisations, right? is a key one. That's a really important one.
Yeah, I totally get what you mean. Holding on to the same meeting structure you had in year one when you've got to 8 figures is probably a bad idea. But Richard, I love that 3 month breakdown. I suspect many of our listeners are going, right, we're doing this as of next week. We're just going to do it ourselves and sort it out, fix all these problems. This time of year is a great time to be doing it. But you are, as you said, a marketer at heart. You're great at growth. So an extra question for you. If you were a CMO at an e-commerce store this year, what would be the key things going into your marketing team? What would you have them working on this year? Would it be a CRM focus? Would you be diving into TikTok shop and channels, doubling down on Meta? What's your recipe, if I can ask?
Oh man, it's so hard. Because I suppose one of the things I always think about, depending on the financial health of the business, I suppose, again, I've sort of put this on a spectrum of, is the business in wartime? So, you know, where it might be thinking, oh, we've got a cash runway of X and we might struggle to pay our team in a few months' time. Or are you at the other end in peacetime where you've got really amazing working capital, high gross margin, you know, free cash flow and profitable. If you're in the more in the peacetime side of the world, I think having a test budget of around, you know, either incremental 20% on top of what you're already spending to test those different things, Chloe, is absolutely brilliant. And actually, it's really exciting for the team, again, perhaps to work cross-functionally around, we've got some money for demand and awareness creation. What are those new and emerging channels that we can go and test and try? So is it Reddit? Is it TikTok? Is it like a remnant snatch deal on above the line posters? Sorry, you know, like our home posters on the underground that I've managed to get. And can we just thinking about that, I suppose, testing and learning, I suppose, principle of, particularly probably if you've got to 8 figures, that's probably, it's part of the business and why it's got there. Can you apply that to new and emerging channels? I always put, I suppose, extra confidence and investment into CRM. I think the more you can do there, and again, AI is doing a great job of helping do more at scale and at pace in that function or in that channel. That's definitely something there. I think never underestimate the power of actually just meeting your customers. So again, if one of the things I spot often, if we've listened to Pure Play D2C listeners and here, Chloe, is that I often ask, who's your top customer? And they go, oh, I don't know. Or who are your top 10? And they don't know the name. They don't know where they live. They don't know anything about them. So spending some time actually either talking or interacting with customers at ideally in different value segments. So very valuable, you know, medium value, low value. And like, what's going on? Why'd you buy it? Why don't you? Who else are you buying? You know, just getting to know them. There's so much comes from those little conversations you can have around a pizza and a beer or some other thing you could do with them relative to your brand. I'll be doing that for sure. I think that kind of the ones come straight to mind. And of course, experimenting with productivity through AI and seeing where that gain is. Is it on content production? Is it on analytics? I'm sure you've seen these, Chloe, as well. You can see there's a lot of power if you can connect truth into these systems to help you make decisions quicker.
E-commerce Master Plan is supported by some of the greatest companies in the e-commerce sector. Here's a reminder of who they are. It's time for the top tips round.
Okay, I love this section because it gives me and our listeners some really quick ideas for taking our businesses to the next level. Rich, are you ready for the top tips?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, the book top tip. If everyone listening to this podcast agreed to take Friday off and read a book to make their business better, which book would you recommend?
Cool. Well, it's really difficult to choose one, but the one that I find most of my people I talk to haven't read is The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard. Written in the 60s, Vance was a consumer psychologist that worked for like the Madison Avenue ad agencies. And it's a brilliant thing around psychological depth of like how cognitive bias consciously and subconsciously works on decision making. So very quick story, and I'm conscious of time, but there's a really good example of this, that one section in the book talks about ad agency were approached by a big chocolate company in the US, and they were asked to design like the full packaging, the pricing architecture, absolutely everything. And they counterintuitively, for let's say lower spending power consumers, the packaging was really, let's say, opulent, lots of bows and foil and ribbons, and you can't see the chocolate. And then for the higher spending power cohort or the target audience, it's all about having clear and open chocolates that you can see the chocolate inside. And that's still true today. If you look at like a £5 box of chocolates, you can't see inside them. It's very sort of nice box. And then the expensive chocolates, you're actually looking at the product inside. So it's this like perception of, am I giving this a gift? Is this for myself? You know, there's lovely things in this book around your offer architecture and thinking of some of the more subconscious decisions that customers make around status and what it says about them and their needs. It's amazing.
Nice. I haven't come across that one. And I think as a marketer, you can't ever read too many books on consumer psychology because it hasn't changed. It's how we're hardwired.
And that's, again, when you think about AI and all the other kind of big, again, where are we going to be in another 20 years when another shift comes of some kind? We still act, I think, unless we've all got AI chips in our heads or anything else, but we still act in actually, there's a brilliant, my second book on there was Thinking Fast and Slow by Danny Kahneman, right? Which is that, again, conscious, slow-thinking brain versus the fast subconscious brain. And that's linked to Vance Packard's one very much.
Yeah, we'll still be wanting our posh chocolates visibly and our cheap chocolates wrapped in boxes.
Yeah, or particularly I'm now the CEO of an apparel brand, what the apparel brand says about me as I'm walking around or when I look at myself in the mirror, right? So there's some interesting things there, again, consciously, subconsciously.
Exactly, right. Number two, traffic top tip. Which marketing method do you either prize above all others or think doesn't get the press it deserves?
Well, I mentioned CRM earlier, so I'm not going to leverage that one again. I have been a big fan my whole career, actually on remnant above the line inventory. There's some amazing deals to do if you approach a media owner directly and say, look, I've got artwork ready. If you can phone me once a week or tell me what you've got left over, I can pick that. And you can usually get deals as good as 10 to 30p on the pound at full rate card. And again, during my play.com days and at the Hut Group in particular, where we used to get like, you know, marketing co-op from brands. There's an amazing arbitrage opportunity there where we would go out and buy remnantry, let's say remnant at 30 pence and the rate card is at 100, right? You can imagine that. And we used to buy tens of millions of eyeballs at, you know, a 70% discount from the rate. Just, but then the flexibility is then knowing I can't plan it exactly around start date, end date, but I've still got that access to the consumer and focus on the frequency. So yeah, there's amazing opportunities in particularly out of home, audio, TV still, if you're in that remnant space.
I've, having started my career in mail order, huge fan of remnant stuff, remnant above the line. Do you know though, the strangest thing, I have never been approached for a last minute deal on podcast sponsorship or email newsletter advertising at the risk of being now being bombarded with it.
Yeah.
No one has ever gone, Chloe, you know, those ads we ran 2 months ago. If you have a space later this year, what could you do it for? You know, because it expires. It's just like the magazine industry or the side of a bus shelter.
I don't know how you feel as well. There's interestingly that, again, I don't think I've probably in the last 10 to 15 years, it's very rare for me to go into an eight-figure brand and find an individual with any traditional above-the-line or non-digital buying experience. And I think even with a perhaps potentially a media buying partner and tell them to focus on remnant, they still get a commission, all those things. There's so much opportunity. And again, I think some of the upsides of why would you do above the line, it has a, still has a trust. And again, there's a brilliant thing, you know, when I think a few years back when Facebook had to apologize around a scandal of some kind, you know, they use billboards and newspaper ads to do it because we trust it.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's a brilliant trust and it does bring you out from the other, let's say, I wouldn't call everyone, you know, bedroom operators. That's not appropriate. But there's a sense of you in the real world suddenly becomes, there's something, again, coming back to our conscious psychology of a consumer. Oh, you've turned up here. You know, why banks used to build big monolithic columned buildings at the end of high streets is because it's around trust. And a similar thing works there in the media choice.
Oh, completely. A tool top tip then, maybe a collaboration tool, a social media plugin, a phone app, or just a way of working. Is there a cool little tool you use that makes you and your team more efficient from day to day?
These aren't tools predominantly, but ways I've kind of built a bit more productivity for myself. So I think turning off all notifications while you're at work, except maybe VIP, but the ease of getting, you know, distracted by a ping or a ding or anything else, absolutely key. There's an amazing feature. I live in the Apple ecosystem now and have done for the last sort of 10 years. I don't know if you, are you in Apple as well, Chloe?
I'm not an Apple, okay. No.
But in the Apple ecosystem, there is a thing called Text Replace where you can put a shortcut on your keyboard and it can replace it with any text. So I've got probably 30 different, like just at and then three letters, and it can replace the thing I type quite frequently. I think generally over the last 5 years, I've saved a week of my working life by not having to copy paste manually or type these things out. And it can be things like email addresses, maps, you know, instructions for X, things like that. And it, you know, calendar link, honestly, like you type it in under a second and it's produced 50 words for you.
Love those kind of tools. I have one myself in my PC world called Type Desk, which has whole emails, you know.
Yeah, like you can insert so them with much. Two character hits on the keyboard. Yeah,
yeah, it's just like Alt C and up it pops. Yeah, type in a bit, few phrases,
sort of like exclamation mark whatever next, like three letters or whatever. Yeah. Right, so that's really key. The other one, I spend a lot of time in spreadsheets, obviously, as a more sort of commercial analytical marketer. Two things that drive me crazy: merge cells, don't merge cells, and learn keyboard shortcuts. Again, the speed. A very quick story about school. When I grew up, it was in the late 80s and early 90s, like going through secondary school. And yeah, there were four computers at school, but I had a guy that taught us like XL1. We didn't have any mice on the computer. Everything was learned by keyboard. And you can see where I'm showing spreadsheets to other like colleagues or people, they're like, see me work the keyboard moving around a spreadsheet so quick, they're like, oh my God, how are you doing that? Instead of like holding the mouse on the scroll to the right-hand side and it takes 30 seconds to get to the other side, I can go straight to the other end of the table in a keystroke. And they're like, how'd you do that? So honestly, spending half hour learning keyboard shortcuts in Excel or Google Sheets.
I love it. I also like your little plea to anyone working with you to not merge the cells in a spreadsheet.
Oh my God, I see a merge cell.
I completely concur with all your recommendations there, Rich.
I think that merge cell feature should be like admin level switch on or offable.
whole company ban.
I cannot see why. I know it's got better over time in the more recent versions, but like, oh my God, merge sales.
I'm with you. Okay, the carbon top tip. What's your favourite way to reduce the carbon footprint of an e-commerce store?
This one actually came up really struggling, to be candid, because obviously I'm now running an agency business and we're pretty light on carbon and all those things. We don't print anything. And I was thinking, ka-ding, got it. I've been working over the last 6 months actually on a lot of subscription supplements businesses, looking at, you know, doing commercial due diligence for investment, all those sort of things. And you can see a material carbon impact, also a commercial benefit. So this is a double win on shipping quarterly instead of monthly. So a quarterly supply on a quarterly basis. So, you know, it's three times as less, you know, the packaging, the fuel, all those things, slightly heavier package. But in terms of cardboard uses and everything else, like, no brainer. And actually what you look at commercially, when I do my LTV analysis over these cohorts that are on the 3 month, they're typically worth more money over the same period of time than a monthly subscriber as well. So that would be...
Love that one. Thank you, Rich. Now, before we say goodbye, could you please let the listeners know how they can get in contact with you and your business?
Yeah, of course. We're at the growth.foundation is our website. There's a form there on the foot of the page, but you can also find me on LinkedIn. I'm just / Richard Chappell. Yeah, and looking forward to hearing from you guys. I'm very open, by the way, for any questions or ideas or anything you want to know. Please feel free to drop me a line.
Awesome. Rich, thank you so much for coming on the show. You've given us all a ton of stuff to think about, which I love. So thank you so much for being here.
No problem.
Always a treat to catch up with Rich. And how do I summarize that? Here's what would you do if you were starting a new job as CEO at an eight-figure fashion brand? I love the way he split it down into what you do in each of the first 3 months. First of all, finding that truth, the truth in the numbers, the truth in the strategy, the truth in how the business is operating and how everyone is kind of culturally aligned. Then month two, getting into strategic alignment, both working out what the strategy should be and then becoming that consistent narrator of strategy, obsessing about the customer and working out where to play and how to win, and then making sure everybody is on board with that and kind of living and breathing it. And then month three, start looking at, is the organization designed to scale? You now know what your strategy is. You know now know you've got the numbers and the truth throughout the business. So how are you going to go about doing that scale organizationally? Has there been enough investment in the CRM? Do you have clarity on your customer insights? How is the CEO working alongside that founder role? Build that, what does the organizational structure need to look like when we're doubled in turnover? How does AI fit into that? How does hiring fit in? How does talent acceleration? That's not the right word, is it? Talent development work. So many bits and pieces. I mean, there's so much just in the top tips that you could pick out, but such a good rundown there from Rich. And I think even if you're not a new person who's just got a new job as CEO at an eight-figure fashion brand, I think we could probably all apply that to our businesses in this off e-commerce season of the spring and work our way through those things to make our businesses tighter and stronger. You can get your hands on our notes from this episode, including those top tips and links to what we've mentioned, by heading over to ecommercemasterplan.com. You can also use ecmp.info/the number of this episode to go straight to the right page of the site. When you get to the website, please do add yourself to our email list so you don't miss out on any of the things we share to help you improve your business. And if you liked this episode, then make sure you check out all our other What Would You Do episodes, which you will find via the website at ecmp.info/WWYD. Thank you for tuning in to this and every episode of the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. I bring you a new interview every week because I want to inspire and help e-commerce business owners like you to succeed and thrive with your businesses, including progressing along the path to net zero. So if you know someone this show can help, please tell them to listen to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. I hope you have a great week and don't forget to keep optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com/podcast.